Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 128 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I have my full complement of co-hosts this week. First is David Vanderhoof, back online after getting hacked. Welcome back, David.
Thanks, Max. Yeah, last week was a bit trying, and I just didn't feel like being on the podcast and being a grumpy after some person decided to hack my Google account, and then Google decided to shut down both of my blogs in protest.
Both are back up, right? What just flew by up. And the Hitchhiker's Guide to Military Aviation, right?
So, yeah, we're getting back in the swing of things, and I'll... It's kind of a hard time of the year to blog, unless you're Dan, because you're finally off from school. But we're getting there, but we're back.
Okay, good. Also here is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Oh, wait a minute. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, sorry.
Rob.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Were those angry birds, Rob?
Those were the angry birds. I'm sorry. I'm hooked on angry birds. It happened when I was on that British Airways flight back from Dubai a couple of weeks ago because the entertainment system was busted. So I had to do something, and
you had to amuse yourself.
Angry Birds took over my life. Uh-huh. Good evening to everybody.
Also with us is Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Thanks always for listening.
Now, Dan, you're recording from on site at the airport, I guess, right?
Yes, I am in Atlanta right now, and the Renaissance Hotel at the Atlanta Airport has these beautiful, beautiful balcony rooms with a wonderful panoramic view of Atlanta Airport. So I am a very happy guy right now. Some really great spotting opportunities. Great views and some good finds. Like, I was very happy to catch one of the Delta aircraft in a SkyTeam livery, for example. So, yeah, it's been a fun, noisy afternoon.
Things in the sky.
Apropos.
Yeah.
That's true. Ooh, wait for it. Yeah. That's nice.
Beautiful.
It's what we live for.
We are dorks. Okay.
No, geeks.
Oh, geeks. Our guest this episode is Jillian Gustafson. She's a board member with the National Air Disaster Alliance Foundation. Jillian, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, this organization was founded by air crash survivors and family members somewhat 15 years ago, I guess, correct?
Yeah, actually, it's been a little bit longer than that because I think that I became just a general member, I guess, in 1996.
Uh-huh.
And I think that the organization existed several years prior to that, so it's been a little longer.
And you are the blogger and the tweeter for the organization, I take it.
I am. I was kind of disappointed with our online presence last year, and I volunteered my services. So I blog less, tweet more, and I just do the best I can to keep up with it all.
Sure. That's great. All right. Well, we'll talk more about that organization shortly. First, though, we're going to talk about the week's aviation news. And following that, we'll have our conversation with Jillian. David is back with This Week in Aviation. David, is this going to be 2 weeks in aviation?
I'm going to be good. I'll just do one.
Okay.
But it is the Christmas season, so I tend to do strange things this time of year.
Remember, Santa is watching.
Yeah, or listening.
Or listening.
We also have Stephen Grant with their Australia Desk Report. And Peter Johnson has a very interesting interview with a fascinating aviator on his Across the Pond segment. So we'll look forward to that. Our first news story comes from USA Today. This is Southwest orders bigger jets. Are Hawaii Caribbean next? And according to this article, or according to the Associated Press, which is quoted in this article, it says that Southwest is going to change the existing order with Boeing and get 20 new 737-800 jets. These are larger than what they had on order. Those are to come in beginning in March of 2012. Probably Dan, you might be able to comment on this one. I guess there's a lot of speculation as to just exactly what Southwest is intending to do with these larger airplanes.
Yeah, so this is interesting because this has been a story that's been developing for a few months. When Southwest said, I believe it was the beginning of August, that, okay, we're looking at the 737-800, which is certainly significant. I mean, Southwest does operate three types of the 737 already, but the bulk of the fleet, the 300 and the 700, are the same size. They both seat 137 seats, and the 500 is a little bit smaller at 122, I believe. So the 800 is a bit bigger. They haven't... I don't think they've given an exact configuration number, but it'll be... So this has been going on since August, and Southwest has had to reopen their contracts with their flight attendants and their pilots. And, I mean, one of the issues with the 800 is because of its size, the way the FAA controls the number of flight attendants, it's by the number of seats. So roughly every 50 seats, you'll need an additional flight attendant. So this would be over 150 seats. So they'll need a fourth flight attendant. So that was one issue. That's a bit of a crew scheduling issue. It opened up the pilot's contract as well. Both the pilots and flight attendants ratified those new tentative agreements. So we kind of knew this was coming. So it's exciting to see. No real details on exactly how many they'll get each year. But there was one article from Dow Jones Newswriters by Doug Cameron that did say Southwest could see up to 70 planes in the fleet by 2014. So it's interesting to see how they use them. Worthy of note is Southwest did say in a blog post these will be configured with Boeing's new Sky Interior,
which is
now into service with Fly Dubai, I believe. Actually, if you guys are interested, John Ostrower had a really interesting blog post. He was able to fly the aircraft with the Sky Interior as well as the new IFE offering from Lumexus. But anyway, I'll have the new Sky Interior, but also be configured for ETOPS operations. And a lot of people are thinking that could mean Southwest is looking at Hawaii service.
Yeah, because ETOPS means over the water.
So obviously you need ETOPS to get to Hawaii. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops. Because the Hawaiian market has been really fun to watch. Well, I wouldn't say fun because it involves some bankruptcies. But interesting to watch because you've seen ATA and Aloha go bust in 2008, which had implications, at least for Aloha, for the inner island market. But you've had Alaska really grow its presence in Hawaii over the past couple of years, which has been really interesting. We've seen Allegiant now looking to enter the Hawaiian market. They were supposed to be doing that this year, but it's been pushed back. But that's still coming. So it's interesting to see how Hawaiian fits in this because they're just getting their new A330s, which has more range, but they're also expanding the region to Asia. So it's fun to watch that market, but it's good for some other airports. Mm-hmm. Southwest has mentioned like slot restricted or gate restricted airports. So like an airport like LaGuardia, Southwest only has 8 slots, I believe. They'll pick up a few more with the AirTran merger. But if you're in a slot controlled airport like LaGuardia or Reagan, if you can't increase your number of flights, the only way to increase your capacity is with a larger aircraft. Also, I think this would be a good fit for Love Field, their big base in Dallas, because part of the compromise to get rid of the Wright Amendment was Love Field, I forget the exact number, will be capped at a certain number of gates. So that seems to make sense as well. So it'll be interesting. It'll be a couple of years, I believe. It'll be a couple of years a little over a year from now, actually, for the first Southwest 800 to be delivered, but it'll be really interesting to see how this gets developed because I think this really shows how much Southwest has changed.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Is Southwest drifting away from what made them successful in the past? And if so, is that a risk?
I think it's almost fair to start considering them a network carrier, not a straight low-cost carrier. Which is fine. Honestly, for a lot of the markets where Southwest grew was these. I mean, U.S. domestic, they have most of the country covered. You need to look for new places to grow. So 800 does that. Hawaii does that. The AirTran merger does that. So I just think it shows how much Southwest has really changed over even just the past 5 years. I mean, 5 years ago, I think if you told people that Southwest would be serving Boston and LaGuardia and Newark, I don't think they'd believe you.
Yeah.
And actually, Southwest did announce their second round of Newark flights today as well. So they'll have Chicago and St. Louis were announced, but they added Baltimore, Houston, Phoenix, and Denver, I believe. So that'll be starting next year, which will be interesting to watch as well. That was part of the compromise with Continental United to get it approved by DOJ.
Hmm.
So interesting stuff.
Okay, we also.
Sorry. One thing. I think it's definitely a change in model, but Southwest has been changing their model for the past couple of years. I mean, they've remained profitable, and I think when you're such a big they're the largest domestic airline, I believe. So when you're such a large airline, I mean, you're going to have to change to continue to grow. Hmm. So
now, how
isn't
about
it interest?
Go ahead, Rob.
I was going to say, isn't it interesting that the comment you just made, Dan, about the fact that Southwest continues to change, and I don't think anyone, at least let me repeat that. I don't think that most people believe that other carriers think that way. I don't think anybody believes United has changed or that Delta has changed their business model. I mean, they pretty much stick with what they've been doing for a long time. But that's the point, is that Southwest continues to evolve gradually, slowly, just like they've always expanded into other cities. And they're still making it work.
I would disagree, because they've slowly expanded over the past few years. But I'd say things over the past few years, like going into cities they typically have avoided, adding the 800, going with in-flight Wi-Fi, I think that what they're doing with some of their ancillary revenue services, like having some kind of premium fare, even though it's not a premium seat, there's still some extra benefits. I think a lot of exciting changes have taken place under Gary Kelly. And that being said, to your point, I think the legacy carriers, yeah, have they changed as much? Maybe not as much. But I think Southwest, you know, starting as a small guy 30 years ago, almost 40 years ago now, it's a little different. But I would say that some of the legacy airlines continue to change. I mean, Delta, I would say, has made some decent strides on the product side over the past couple of years, for example. So,
well, yeah. Speaking of Delta, we see in Bloomberg that Delta is planning to increase its first-class seating, at least in the domestic fleet, by 13% within the next 3 years. That's a pretty healthy growth in the premium seating section, isn't it?
So Delta is increasing the size of its first class cabin on some fleets, like the MD-80 from 14 to 16, the MD-90 from 12 to 16, and a couple others. And I mean, that's good for the elites. Like Delta has domestic free upgrades for elites. Obviously, I mean, the higher you go, the better chance you'll get a first class seat. So that obviously makes them happy. But what's interesting is it says the seating upgrade, which also includes additional economy class seats, will be added as Delta revises its galley space to improve the efficiency of its aircraft. The amount of legroom offered on Delta seats in both economy and first class will not change. Of course, because I'm a seat pitch guy, I found that interesting. But what's interesting is the economy cabin isn't taking a hit size-wise, which I think is smart.
Oh, they're freeing up space to use for a premium seating, first class seating.
Yes, and I think that's smart.
Sure, it's more seats per aircraft, right? There's more revenue per flight.
Well, but also, if you would reduce, at least this is the way I'm thinking of it, if you increase your space for first class while reducing the size of the economy class cabin, you're going to have less first class seats in the same space you would for economy space seats. So that means less available seat miles if you're reducing total seat count, which is the general metric that you'll use for allocating your costs for CASM, for cost per available seat mile. So if you're not reduced, so if you would reduce your ASMs, that I think there would be some pressures there. That's just my wild speculation, but that's one reason why I think it's smart. But I think, yeah, I mean, increase the size of the aircraft, you're removing some galley space, especially if it's not really being used, why not? And hey, if it's going to make the elites happy, I mean, that's good. I mean, every airline likes courting business travelers, and if Delta can say, "Hey, if you're flying us, and if you're loyal to us, and you're elite, we're increasing your chances of getting a first class seat on our domestic flights," I think that's a really good sales pitch.
Yeah. Okay.
By the way, on a side note, I just like to point out the reason I'm in Atlanta is I'm actually going to be spending the day with Delta tomorrow. So their PR department was very kind to invite me down. Cranky Flyer and Brett Snyder and David Parker Brown from Airline Reporter, they were in Atlanta as well. So in the full disclosure department, Delta actually was very nice and comped my flights and hotel. But yeah, all this right, is... Yeah, it should be exciting.
Yeah, it should be. And it's great that they're having folks like you and those other guys come down and talk with them.
Yeah.
All right. Next up, this is from the United States Department of Transportation, a press release. This is U.S. Transportation Secretary LaHood receives recommendations on future of aviation. Now, we've talked about this in the past, I believe, the Future of Aviation Advisory Committee. And that was created to take a look at the future of aviation and to make recommendations to the DOT secretary. The committee is made up of representatives from airlines, airports, labor, manufacturers, finance, academicians. We even have one general aviation participant, and they've produced their report and released some recommendations. According to the press release, the committee has focused on five major areas. Those are aviation safety, world-class aviation workforce, the industry's competitiveness and viability, funding for aviation systems, and environmental challenges and solutions. So a number of interesting things came out of this. Some of them safety related. Jillian, maybe you might be familiar with one of these with regard to infant seats in airlines.
Yeah, it's an interesting position that they took on the prevalence. Well, I guess it's the standard now that babies under the age of two will sit on their parents' laps.
Right.
It's not really safe to do that, and the FAA made limited efforts to educate parents that that's not really a safe way to go. But I think that it's nice that they recommended that the issue be studied more, and I think it opens the door for potential rulemaking at the FAA, but we would have liked to have seen a stronger statement in that regard, that maybe it be mandated. And I know the NTSB has taken that perspective as well. So they had a symposium a couple of weeks ago on the safety of lap babies or lack thereof.
Right.
And industry generally has said that they aren't going to do anything until it's mandated. And I guess we're hoping that it gets mandated.
What do you think is the reason for their resistance? Is it because the flying public, you know, is trying to save money and, you know, not purchase an additional seat, or is it something else?
Yeah, I think there is a presumption, and I say presumption because I don't think the FAA actually has any studies to back up their financial justification of this. The premise that they're working off of is that parents, if they had to pay for an extra seat, might not fly.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, more babies tend to die in automobile accidents and in plane incidents.
Right.
And so they think that there would be an increase in babies dying in cars. And I find that, well, it's just a huge extrapolation.
Mm.
I think parents probably want to see their kids be safe however method they choose to travel. But I don't know. We'll see how this goes from here. I know Chairman of the NTSB, Herzman, actually made a statement on the 15th of December that said that they were disappointed that it wasn't a mandate, but they were happy that it was moving in the right direction.
Right.
So we're pretty much on board with that.
Now, I have a quick question, just because obviously as a non-parent, I really don't know much about traveling with children. So let's say If I would have to buy a ticket for a child under two, is there any special safety device that's needed for a child of that size?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of different solutions. It's like a car seat. You have a couple different solutions based on the size and weight of the child. Babies would probably have to have some sort of car-like device that would be strapped into the seat. The only device that's been approved by the FAA to hold toddlers, I guess it would be, I think, I'm not sure of the weight requirements for the CARES device, but kidsflysafe.com. The CARES device is actually the FDA-approved device for not necessarily babies, but not necessarily over two-year-olds. And it's a specialized seatbelt that has, well, it kind of protects them more so. You have over-the-shoulder straps that kind of lock into the regular seatbelt. So,
but you know what I think makes this interesting, too, is that following up on what Jillian said, I mean, a lot of the impetus for what the FAA did came from the flight attendants, actually, because they were kind of the first-line people to watch the, you know, to, I think, notice the dangers that some of these people were putting their kids in. And, you know, how many decades has it been since we've required little kids to be in seats in cars? I don't know. We don't even think about it anymore in a car. And yet, when it comes to an airplane, we think that's okay. In fact, I remember when my daughter's 16 now, and when she was an infant, we took her on her first trip, and maybe she was, I don't know, 4 months old or something, to California out of O'Hare, and I brought the car seat, and it had a little insert because she was still pretty tiny. I think she was only about 8 pounds, and you know, kept it from flopping around. And I brought the seat in the airplane, and we bought a seat for her. I mean, I've never not bought a seat for her ever since she was born, but and that's probably because I fly. But you know, what I thought was interesting is at the time the flight attendant said, "You can't use that. You can't put that seat in there."
It's
and
true.
I said, "Why not?" She said, "Well, it's not approved."
Right.
And I said, "Well, you know what? Tough. I'm not holding. I bought a seat for my daughter, and I am not holding this baby on my lap because it's dangerous. And if you don't like it, well, then I guess we'll have to argue about it." And they just kind of turn the itch and let me do it. But they didn't like it.
I think that's changed. Yeah, it puts the flight attendants in an awkward position because a car seat is probably safer for a baby, but there's no instruction that says that's okay for them. So
yeah.
And we had our annual meeting in October, and we gave our aviation safety award for the year to a woman by the name of Jan Brown. And she is a retired United flight attendant who has kind of made it her mission after being a survivor of the disaster of United 238, which was in 1989 in Sioux City. And there was a child that died on that plane because the flight attendants were instructed to tell the parents that in an emergency situation, you put the baby on the floor of the plane. And there were kids that died. And that was a really sad experience for her. And it will, you know, she says it will stick with her forever that she told the parents the wrong thing to do. And it's really heartbreaking to hear her story.
Is the issue with small children turbulence? Is that where the danger is?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. I mean, I've seen some pretty violent and been in some pretty violent air turbulence, and many times it's completely unexpected. It just happens. And if you're not, you know, buckled in, you're against the ceiling. And I just can't imagine, you know, a responsible parent not wanting to protect their child from that kind of a situation.
Right.
But, you know, parents don't really – I think parents that fly, if parents that flew were somehow convinced that it is just as dangerous, if not more so, to hold that baby on their lap,
because you're not going to be able
argue
to
about the money. Yeah, you'll never be able to hold the baby.
No, I think the forces are too great.
And, of course, every parent thinks that they can do the best to protect their child, but the circumstances just don't allow that to be the case.
Right.
But, you know, one other thing I would just like to say on this topic before we move on. I mean, I sat through the whole session last week with the DOT's FAAC committee. And other than this piece about lap babies, there were maybe one or two financial issues, I think, that really jumped out at me. But the rest of it was pretty much of a yawner. It really was. I think it was probably one of the best PR spectacles I've seen in a long time, but
that's just my
two cents. Yeah, there wasn't much to it. There really wasn't.
Well, I guess one of the recommendations was about next-gen air traffic control, and we talked about that last week, but wasn't the recommendation that they wanted the government to speed the development and address the funding issues?
Well, Jack Pelton, who chaired the finance committee, who is the CEO of Cessna, mentioned their perspective on that, which was one of the ones I thought was good, which was a public-private partnership of some sort to fund this. But what really got me upset about this entire committee, and has since the day it was formed, early in the year, is that it really should have been called the Future of the Airline Advisory Committee, because almost everything that came down the other day, in fact, at the end of the session, the DOT secretary came in and let everybody explain the recommendations to him, and every comment that everybody made was airline focused. And I know the DOT secretary doesn't believe that probably, but it was really nothing more than about the airlines, and that's really what I think is a shame, because there are so many elements of general aviation and business aviation that really impact the airlines. Let's talk about employees. Where they come from. It's usually from the general aviation side before they ever make it to the airlines. And that wasn't even discussed, as if it was even an issue.
Hmm. Rob, I think we may have had this discussion before, but could part of it be the fact that, by the way, yes, incomplete. I'm watching the Patriots game. they have sacked, and then they incomplete pass. So the Packers will have to go for a field goal instead, unless they're going to go for it. But who knows? Anyway, but I think we've had the discussion before. Is it just because that maybe politically not that many people care about GA?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at where the money and where the influence is, look at the organization that represents the airlines, the Air Transport Associations. It's very politically powerful. It has a lot of money. Remember when they did? I think we did talk about this. They had the Aetna commercials a couple of years ago when they were trying to get user fees going. And general aviation is as wonderful as I think AOPA and EAA and GAMA and some of the other groups are. They're not as well tied together as the airlines side are. So I don't think they've done nearly as good a job at telling their story. Look at what happened after the Detroit thing, where the car makers tried to take their jets to Washington a couple of years ago to ask for money, and everybody still doesn't want to talk about the use of their business airplanes. It's still very hush hush, and so no one knows who you are or what you do. It's probably not surprising that people don't support you.
Well, there was another report that came out this past week. This one is reported in the Associated Press. FAA routinely misses airline inspection deadlines. And this came from the DOT Inspector General. The article says that, or mentions that, the Inspector General identified several weaknesses in a key FAA airline maintenance oversight program, and says unless the FAA fixes those weaknesses, its ability to effectively oversee the nation's aviation system is lessened. I think what they're looking at is a program that the FAA started some time ago, where they first looked at 10 U.S. airlines, large U.S. airlines. That's expanded now to 94 airlines. And the AP piece mentions that they are analyzed to see if they have designed an effective overall maintenance program, and that FAA inspections are concentrated on the riskiest areas. So what they found is that the FAA has not been keeping up with its schedule of inspections, and in fact can be as much as 8 years behind in those inspections, this representing an unsafe situation. So I don't know. What do you guys think? Is this is there something here?
Well, I think it's kind of scary, but I can't say that it's necessarily surprising to me.
Yeah.
I think the FAA kind of has a history of these issues, and they need to do better. It just it's disappointing.
They do seem to be behind quite often.
Right, and I think that in their role is kind of fulfilling that oversight over the airlines and stuff, it's kind of crucial that they keep up with that. I know that's a bit of an understatement, but it's true. And I thought it was interesting in the article that it said that that some of the violations were disclosed by an FAA whistleblower. And I think recently the Senate actually passed an Enhanced Protection Act for the whistleblowers, but the House is still kind of sitting on it. But I think that's kind of a key portion. If you have people inside that are willing to, you know, escalate some of these things, nothing happens unless there's attention paid to those sorts of reports.
Sure. One of the ironic things that I found in this article is it also mentions that the Inspector General, who released this report, spent more than 3 years reviewing the FAA program. So I guess whether it's the FAA or whether it's the Inspector General, nothing seems to move very quickly in the federal government.
Hey, wait a minute. Was that a backhanded comment about the tanker controversy?
Oh, that too. How's that going, David?
It's going and going and going and going.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. Another story. This is a kind of interesting one. Dan Services. This is from U.S. News and World Report. Best Careers 2011. U.S. News did a, they did a survey. Not a survey. They did a study. I'll call it a study, where they looked at some Bureau of Labor Statistics data and other information they had available. And they came up with their list of 50 of the best careers for 2011. And guess what makes the list? Commercial pilots. Believe it or not. They say that employment is expected to grow for pilots 19% through 2018. They figure an estimated 7,300 new jobs will be added. Now, they do mention with respect to money that the median income last year in 2009 for commercial pilots was $65,840. But that's the median, and they mention that many jobs at regional airlines are far below that, which of course we know. What do you think, Dan? Think there's a pilot job in your future?
Well, probably not for me, because I'd have to scrap the 2.5 years of school and start going. I guess I just found it interesting because because the way the industry has been the past couple of years, I guess I was just a little surprised to see the headline. And maybe Rob can add a little bit more here since he's a CFI and he's trains potential future pilots a bit. But I guess the thing is it really a best career, especially on the regional side, when the pay is really low? I think many rightfully argue that it's maybe too low. And
yeah, at the regional level.
Especially if you have people who are stuck at the regionals for a while. I mean, I think this goes great if people can go from a regional to a mainline carrier pretty quickly. And Rob probably knows better than I do, but I think over the past couple of years, you've had people who are stuck at the regionals, who've been stuck at the regionals. So I don't know. I'm just always cautious that there are all these optimistic forecasts about how the industry is going to grow and employment is going to be great, and it just doesn't always come to be. But it was just a surprising headline, I thought.
Well, I thought it was interesting also the commercial pilot jobs is part of the category that they label creative and service jobs. So in there with commercial pilot, there's curator, film and video editor, gaming manager, I'm not sure what that is, heating, air conditioning, and refrigeration technician, interpreter/translator, multimedia artist, and technical writer. That's quite a broad spectrum,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Well, yeah. Well,
I like curator. I'm good for that.
And then the other thing I was considering is I wonder if the prediction adjusts for the Michael O'Leary pilot item.
Say that again? What?
I was wondering if that prediction, if that includes Michael O'Leary's prediction that we can fly airplanes with one pilot.
With one pilot, yeah. Yeah, I bet they didn't factor that in, right? Okay. Next news item.
I was really hoping for Rob to chip in on that one.
I think Rob's
opened the door a few times.
He did, but I think Rob's taking an old man's break. All right, the Seattle Times tells us Dreamliner's woes pile up. Boy, you know, if it isn't one delay, it's another. Poor Boeing. The Seattle Times tells us that Boeing is preparing to announce yet another delay for the 787 Dreamliner. At least 3 months, probably six or more. Now, they mentioned a number of items that are causing Boeing fits with the 787. They mentioned the recent in-flight electrical fire. Also, they mentioned issues with Rolls-Royce engines. An FAA official actually has warned Boeing that without further proof of the plane's reliability, it won't be certified to fly the long intercontinental routes that airlines expect it to serve. Another item that Boeing is struggling with is apparently what they're calling rain in the plane. And that refers to some apparent condensation that's forming inside the jet and dripping somewhere or other. So there's a lot of things going on. It's, you know, there's still a huge backlog. The article mentions that, yeah, there have been a number of cancellations. What's the number? Maybe 120, I think, cancellations. Yet Boeing still has 846 orders on the book, so that's nothing to sneeze at. But, I mean, this is the plane that everybody was just so excited about, and you know, here again, more and more and more delays.
That's a pretty horrible quote in the article that says, the perfect storm of manufacturing hell.
Oh, yes.
That's so heavy.
It really is.
And I just think that the way I look about it is this airplane was supposed to be in service, I believe, summer, like late spring, early summer 2008, I believe. I'm not sure if anyone knows if I'm remembering correctly. But this thing was supposed to be in service before I was moving into college.
Yeah.
I just finished the first semester of my junior year. And I guess the way things keep going is I wonder, you know, will this thing be flying when I graduate?
I hope so.
But I mean, this affects airlines' plans. I mean,
oh yeah, sure.
Continental was planning to fly Houston to Auckland and Houston to Lagos a little bit less than a year from now. And Houston Lagos now is being operated with 777, and I believe Houston Auckland has been delayed. So yeah. I mean this kind of really screws up airline strategic plans.
And not to mention, think of how much money this is probably costing Boeing. I mean, I can't even imagine how many airframes they're going to need to build to break even on this airplane, if they ever do. Maybe they never will.
Well, on cost to Boeing and relating back to what Dan was just saying, you know, it's very typical for airlines to, you know, write into their contracts with Boeing or with Airbus clauses that allow them compensation for monetary damage when there's a delay or something like that. And this article mentions that analysts estimate, now I don't know who those analysts are, but quote, analysts estimate that Boeing's cost overruns on this airplane are going to amount to about $12 billion. Huge. That's just huge.
Yeah, and I don't know that they'll ever break even on that. They used to laugh at the A380, and everyone would say that, you know, that Airbus will never build enough of them to break even. And my guess is that Boeing never will on the 787 either.
Yeah, it's, I don't know what their break even point is. They certainly, as we said, they do have a huge number of orders in the backlog. Even if they do break even on the airplane, which I think they will, this really delays out into the future that break even point, you know, many, many years, and that's a cash flow issue, which is not great.
Well, it'd be interesting. What's the price? What's the retail price on a 787? Anybody know?
If you give me a second, Boeing list prices.
Jillian, do you know this?
I actually don't. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
The list price. So I'm on Boeing's website right now, and they have a chart of the prices, and it says $2010 and millions average. So I'm not sure if that's list or just average, but whatever. But it says price for a 787-8, $185.2 million, 787-9, $218.1 million.
All right, but even figure it at the $185 million, I'd really love to know, maybe one of our listeners knows, I wonder what Boeing's cost to build that airplane is, if they sell it for $185 million.
Well, and I guess the other thing is what...
Well, Rob, if they keep having problems like this, they haven't really built many of them, so for most of these people, the cost is nothing for them to have built them.
No. I realize that. No, but I was looking in terms of cost and then what their profit would be on each airplane if things were going along swimmingly. You know, if this they make $20 million on every airplane or something, you could figure out how long it was going to take to go through. What'd you say, Max? $12 billion.
Yeah, $12 billion. Yeah,
it's a lot of dough.
It's a lot of dough.
This makes me think. It's been a few months. We got to have Ostrauer on at some point.
We'll have him straighten us out. Okay, we have one remaining news story. This is a breaking news story, actually, and David handled this one.
Good afternoon. This is David. I'm here with Major Michael Humphreys of the North American Aerospace Defense Command. He is going to discuss a little bit about NORAD, and then we're going to talk about tracking a specific bogey that this time of year. Major Humphreys, welcome to the show, and tell me a little bit about NORAD.
Well, NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, was created in 1957 with a following a binational agreement between Canada and the United States. It originally started as the North American Air Defense Command, and then space was added later, and it became the North American Aerospace Defense Command. But our current missions include aerospace warning, aerospace defense, aerospace warning, aerospace control, and maritime warning for all of North America. And we do that in conjunction with our Canadian allies.
And I have an image of NORAD being geodesic domes up in snow-capped North Pole and F-106 intercepting pairs. It's a little more sophisticated than that these days, correct?
Yeah, well, we use many different types of technologies with radar systems scattered throughout North America, satellite imagery. We also work in conjunction with our interagency partners, Federal Aviation Administration, Transport Canada. Then there's also our fellow co-commands, Air Force Space Command, U.S. Strategic Command, those different commands. We all work together as part of a system to complete our mission here in North America.
And, Major, okay, this time of year you track a high-value target on December 24th. What kind of technology do you use to track Santa Claus as he goes ripping through the world delivering his toys?
Well, I'd be cautious with the connotation that would go along with using the term target. I guess we'd prefer to call him a track of interest. And that is, of course, Santa Claus, good old Saint Nick from the North Pole. I already mentioned some of our technologies, such as the such as our radar. There are 47 radar sites throughout North America that we use to actually, you know, track Santa once he enters into North American airspace. We also have satellites that are capable of picking up heat signatures. Most of the time, those satellites are looking for specific heat signatures that might be, you know, an incoming missile, for example. But in this case, Rudolph's nose shows up very well on those satellites. And something else that we use specifically for this time of year, and only this time of year, is our Santa cams that are scattered throughout the world, located in very specific geographical areas where people are very familiar with, so that, you know, when Santa passes by those areas, you know, we get a picture of him, you know, he waves through the camera, he knows we're there, he knows we're watching him, and it lets people know where he is in the world.
Well, since we have a bunch of pilots on here, one of the questions that came to my mind is, when the president is aboard Air Force One, he gets a specific call sign, Air Force One. Does Santa have a specific call sign that he radios to you folks?
Well, that's a good one, actually. I'm sure he does, but because we don't, I'm not aware of that one. You know, he doesn't communicate with us specifically, other than we do some visual communications when our jets interact with him in North American airspace. You know, we have both Canadian and U.S. forces aircraft that will escort Santa as he crosses North America. Just, you know, kind of keep the way open for him, you know, kind of advise him of any obstacles that could be in the way. Although we are very, you know, very aware that Santa's flying abilities far exceed our own, and his Santa magic exceeds our own current technology. So, you know, he pretty much gives us an opportunity just to participate. You know, he slows down for us so our jets can keep up with him when he crosses North America. They'll come up, do a little, you know, nod of the wings and wave at him so that he knows he's there, and he'll wave back. And sometimes they'll take some pictures and say hello. But other than that, we really don't communicate with him too much when he actually takes off.
I know that I look forward to every year going to NORADTrackSanta.com and see the Santa cams. And we do have a worldwide listener. So our Australia desk, they will see Sydney, and our UK listeners can see Great Britain. But I really appreciate you taking the time today for this brief interview. I know you're incredibly busy, and there's a lot of prep to go on with what's going to happen on December 24th. So Merry Christmas to you, and thank you for taking the time.
Merry Christmas to you, too, and thank you for having me.
All right, David, thank you for that.
That was a really cool interview. Thank you, David.
David, did you know he's making all that up.
No, he's not.
No, he's not. What are you talking about?
Now, here, I'll tell you why he's not making it up. About 10 minutes after I had the interview, Major Humphreys emailed me. They just had gotten a media release from the Federal Aviation Administration, and Santa was designated a call sign for December 24th through December 25th. And that call sign is Santa One. And that's officially from the FAA.
Santa One.
And that's because of you.
If you see it in the FAA, it must be so.
There you go.
So wait, David, is the call sign because of you? Or is that just a coincidence?
I think it's just a coincidence, and it's the obvious call sign.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a coincidence.
I don't either. I think David's responsible. Way to go.
I'm
going to
tell everybody it's because of David.
I'm going to tell everybody I know how come Santa One got the call sign.
I would like to thank the Public Affairs Office of the North American Aerospace Command, Major Humphreys and Stacy, for granting us the ability to have that interview.
Yeah, that was terrific.
That's really, really good. And we all know what Rob's going to get down his chimney on Christmas Eve.
And what's that?
I believe sacks of jelly beans.
Our guest this episode again is Jillian Gustafson. Jillian's a board member with the National Air Disaster Alliance Foundation. Jillian, how did you first come to know about the National Air Disaster Alliance Foundation?
Well, like many of our members, not in a not very positive way, I guess. Most of our members are either aviation disaster survivors or lost family members on plane crashes.
Uh-huh.
And so I fall into the latter category. And I lost a family member on TWA 800 in 1996. And I guess at that point, it's interesting because tonight on 60 Minutes, Meredith Whitney was talking about state and local finance. And she actually said, people don't pay attention until they have to.
Right, yes.
And safety is one of those things as well. So it's an interesting group of people, obviously. We all have a lot in common, but also we're all quite different and everyone's disaster is a little bit different. So it's been an interesting process, but definitely worthwhile. And I hope I'm doing a decent job of doing the social networking on behalf of the organization.
Sure. Now, this is not a tiny group, right? There are quite a number of members.
No, I was asking Gail, our executive director, about our membership because I'm not really I didn't know before a couple of days ago how many people there were.
Okay.
But over 6,000, and most of them are domestic, but we have international members as well.
Right. What do members typically receive, or what is the value that they get from the organization?
Our mission revolves around promoting safety, security, and survivability for aviation passengers, and also support to victims' families. But we probably fulfill a little bit less of the support function other than networking with like-minded people.
Okay.
We definitely recommend that people who are in the midst of a disaster seek professional support, because that's really the best the best way to go about getting emotional support in a very traumatic situation.
Sure. And so the organization does a lot of advocacy for safety, I guess. Is that the way to describe it?
Yeah, absolutely. Gail, our executive director, and Matt, our president, actually spend a lot of time here in Washington, D.C., and most of our members do a lot of communication with legislators and agencies, try and kind of further the causes. So it is, you know, a networking thing, but also advocacy.
Are there current issues that are sort of at the forefront of the organization's mind right now?
Well, I think that the lap baby issue is a big one for us.
Okay, yeah.
We found a great champion in NTSB Chairman Deb Herzman. She has kind of put that on her agenda, and we're very grateful for that because it's something that we've kind of advocated for some time. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, I guess the most recent disaster was the Continental Connection flight in Buffalo, which happened, yeah, I guess it's been over a year. But, you know, the mission of those families, we've tried to support as much as we can. Issues of pilot fatigue and training, that sort of thing. So they've worked very hard to see those elements mm-hmm. of the safety agenda kind of pushed forward.
Now, what kind of background or skills or experience does the organization or the board members, you know, have that, you know, that brings, you know, sort of a basis for, you know, good recommendations and sound thinking in this area? What are the qualifications essentially of the, you know, the important folks in the organization?
It's interesting because, like I said, everybody who's associated with a different disaster kind of has a different experience to bring to the table.
Okay.
We do have other professionals, whether they be counseling professionals or aviation attorneys. We have we worked pretty closely with Mary Schiavo, who's a former she's an attorney, but also a former Department of Transportation Inspector General. So she consults with us quite a bit. And I wouldn't say that there's one particular skill set. I think everybody brings something different. So,
okay.
Yeah.
How about funding? This must be a nonprofit organization.
It is. And we survive off donations. And we have quite a book collection, actually, that through our website we sell a lot of books. And that goes to our bottom line as well.
And you mentioned you were originally just a regular member.
Right.
And what kind of motivated you to take a stronger role and become a board member?
Well, I had volunteered my services to write for the blog, and I think it's just through my own to make the website a little bit better, and then my involvement with Twitter that they started utilizing me more, and I think mm-hmm. that kind of led to my promotion to being a board member.
So you sort of saw a need and sort of stepped up and volunteered to fill that gap.
Yeah, it's interesting with all of the people that I saw on Twitter, including you all, I saw a lot of pilots. I saw a lot of travelers. I saw a lot of perhaps flight attendants or industry people, other industry people, business people who were promoting aviation, but not too many people were addressing safety. So I figured that was a good niche to kind of fill. I'm not sure if that's true, but hopefully people are paying attention.
And are you finding a good response on Twitter from folks?
It's really interesting. I'm kind of surprised by how many people internationally have reached out to me. I maybe didn't expect that as much, but I think I am getting a little bit of traction domestically as well, so that's good. And if anyone wants to follow me, they can at plainsafe.org.
Great. And we should tell folks what the website is also for the foundation.
Right. And the website is plainsafe.org. And then the Twitter is just plainsafe.org. Easy to remember.
Yes, absolutely. Oh,
Julian, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Because we were talking about the story last week. Does the organization have any official stance on the Concorde verdict?
I was fearful that you might ask that. I think our board was having a lot of email correspondence about that. I wouldn't say that we necessarily do. I think it's interesting how every disaster is going to take its own path in terms of the legal ramifications. I think internationally there has been more, I want to say more of an inclination to bring criminal charges than we've seen here in America, which right. I'm not really sure what that's due to, but it's just maybe a different cultural situation. But I know the Japanese have talked about that a little bit as well. And it's just a different approach than we see here in America.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Yeah, what did you I didn't hear necessarily what you guys were talking about last week. So,
yeah, no, that's okay. Yeah, the issue was that when accidents are treated as criminal investigations, that that's going to have an impact on the freedom that people have to speak about what they know. In other words, you know, if there could be criminal charges, people will, you know, clam up and try to protect themselves and worry about that issue rather than just, you know, getting to a full understanding of the causes and the factors behind the accident so that that can be prevented in the future. People will just behave differently if the penalty is going to jail versus if the penalty is just, you know, learning the truth.
Exactly. Yeah, I do get that, and it was interesting that we had a Japan is just recently investigating how they can they have established a transportation safety board, but how they can provide family assistance in the case of accidents, and I think that it came out that they were quite interested in criminal prosecution, and that seemed, I have to say that I guess our reaction was kind of along those lines, like, oh, why would you want to do that? We're not used to seeing that here. So that's just a cultural difference.
Yeah, I agree. I think it really is culturally based.
Yeah.
And so the way we left the conversation, which was without resolution, was, so, you know, what do we do? You know, is there a way to affect that cultural perspective and try to stay away from criminal investigations? But I don't think we really had a solution.
Right. I think it's complicated.
Yeah, it's very complicated.
Yeah.
You know, I was going to ask you something, though, Jillian, too. I mean, listening to what you were talking about and learning that you lost someone on TWA-800, do you find that there are people that I guess I want to talk about people. Let's talk about me. I'm very interested in what you have to say, but there are times I'm almost aghast at not knowing what to say to someone right. that lost someone in an aircraft crash. I mean,
yeah, I think it's interesting being in a group like this because I don't feel that unique among these people. So I guess I have a bit of a bias that I don't want to say that we are regular people. It's just that we were put in a weird, awful circumstance that we lost somebody. But I don't necessarily, I think it's easy enough to express your condolences and move on, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, what else can you say?
Yeah, well, that's true, I guess.
It's
just a thought.
I actually thought you might ask something about that accident. So I'm kind of glad you didn't. Well, not glad, but I think it's interesting because people may or may not know the circumstances of a particular accident. And that's a different complicating factor. Like if people want to speculate as to the investigation not being legitimate, then I'm not really willing to have that conversation. So.
Yeah, and there were issues surrounding that with that particular accident. I refreshed my understanding of the accident and the investigation and the details surrounding that by doing a little online research before this. And you know, it's amazing how many details there are, how many angles there are, just a body of facts associated with these things. And when the accident was as long ago as TWA-800. I was just amazed at how much of that I had forgotten. It was just kind of an interesting experience for me personally to go back and read through it again and remember, you know, just exactly, you know, what happened and what some of the issues were. I think it's in a strange kind of way, I think it was a valuable experience.
Yeah, I think, and certainly I don't fault anybody for not knowing perhaps as much as I've learned over the years, but I guess I guess that's the thing, the hard thing about being a family member who's someone in a plane crash is that investigations take a long time, and I think people expect immediate answers. The media expects immediate answers, and it doesn't really work out that way most of the time. So you have to have a bit of patience in getting to the truth. And
yeah, I think you're right, Jillian. It's any time there's a, you know, any kind of an incident, and we've had a few, you know, in the recent past, and you look at the progression of quote facts as reported by the news, and they change over time.
Absolutely.
And it really does take quite a bit of investigation, quite a bit of checking, quite a bit of, you know, piecing together the the pieces of the puzzle to arrive at, you know, sort of some conclusions that you can count on. All that takes a long time. And, you know, depending on the circumstances and depending on, you know, what evidence you have available to you, it can take a real long time. So do you have an annual fundraising event or anything like that? If you know, any of our listeners, you know, would like to contribute to
that? Yeah. I think listeners who would like to contribute can go to our website. I know that Gail was working with another couple of board members to do some fundraising endeavors in 2011. So I think that our website will have that information. And certainly I'll promote that on Twitter when the information becomes available to me.
That's great. We'll continue to follow you and look for your continued blog posts as well.
Thank you so much.
Jillian, I actually have one last question. What do you think you would suggest as the next couple of steps, maybe for a group like this, as to where they should be headed? I mean, are they kind of operating at the limit of what they can affect, do you think, in the world of safety, or is there more that they could do?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I communication is really key, and I don't have any visibility to how communicative our members are with legislators and agencies, but I know I do my best to kind of reach out to them. I feel like if there was a more coordinated effort in that regard, that might make a difference. I'm not entirely sure, but I do think communication is pretty big.
All right. Well, you keep at it. And,
yeah.
And as I mentioned, we'll look forward to following your activities and that of the organization. And we look forward to, maybe talking with you again in the future. If there are some other issues that, you know, you guys want to communicate or word that you want to get out, we'd be happy to help with that.
Okay. Well, thank you. I really appreciate the invitation to participate, and I hope that I lived up to your expectations.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Jillian.
Thanks, Jillian.
Thanks, Jillian.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Before we continue, we've got an interesting message that came from Peter.
This is Peter Johnson, along with some friends from across the pond, wishing all of our listeners a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Hi everyone, this is Steve, or Thermalhound on Twitter, and I'd just like to wish all the Airplane Geeks and their listeners a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year from across the pond.
This is Carlene Pettit wishing you all a Merry Christmas from across the pond and a very Happy New Year.
Hi, this is Yvette from Airlines Angel wishing all the listeners of Airplane Geeks a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year from across the pond.
So, wherever you are in the world, have a happy holiday and be safe.
And thanks to Peter Johnson for that.
All right, ignorant question. I thought it was Happy Christmas across the pond.
Happy Christmas?
Yeah, I thought they said Happy Christmas in the UK.
Yeah, they do. Actually, he's trying to fit in, I think.
He's trying to fit in.
Yeah. Good job, Peter.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter and Carlene and everyone else.
Yeah, it was neat.
That was very nice. That was very nice. All right, and now with This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 2, Episode 40, December 19th through December 25th. December 19th, 1928, Harold Pitcairn flies his first autogyro in Spain. Pitcairn would buy the license from Juan Cerva and eventually build them in a little town of Horsham, Pennsylvania. That little field would spark a child's love of airplanes. Eventually, it would grow to be Willow Grove Naval Air Station. Thanks, Harold. December 19th, 1978. The DC-10 is chosen to become the U.S. Air Force's supplemental tanker. Like the KC-135 being built as a result of the need of a jet tanker to support Strategic Air Command, or SAC's Jet Bomber Force, the KC-10A was a direct result of the C-5As not being able to carry their full payloads for Operation Nickel Glass, the support of Israel in the Yom Kippur War. The Advanced Tanker Cargo Aircraft Program evaluated four aircraft. Eventually, the finalists were the 747 and the DC-1030, the DC-1030 winning. December 21st, 1979. The NASA Ames Dryden 1, or AD-1, not to be confused with the Sky Raider, the AD-1 tested the flight characteristics of the oblique wing flight. The wing could be pivoted so that the right side of the wing was swept forward and the left backward 60 degrees. So imagine a wing diagonally across the fuselage. The AD-1 would eventually make 79 flights during the program, which ended in 1982. December 23rd, 1910, 100 years ago, on this Wednesday, a young lieutenant would be the Curtiss Airplane Company to learn to fly. That lieutenant, Theodore Gordon Spuds Ellison, upon his completion of training, would be United States Naval Aviator number one. Ellison would then help Glenn Curtiss design the first pontoon-equipped aircraft. Thus, we begin to celebrate the centenary of U.S. Naval Aviation, the greatest naval air arm in the world. So, fly Navy. So, I'm going to skip first flights this week to continue a tradition. Last year, I sang for this episode the 12 Days of Christmas, if everybody remembers.
Oh, yes.
I worked hard at trying to recreate the magic, but I have yet to do it. So I decided to give you the also-rans that came forth through this year. So let me start with, I saw someone kissing Dana Claus underneath the mistletoe last night. Yeah, not. Or there was, all I want for Christmas is a jet wine button, a jet wine button, gee, a jet wine button. Gee, if I could only have a jet wine button, then I can be like the rest of the geeks. Or there was, good King Mac's flight looked out upon his computer empire, editing ums and pops and pings completely out to his mire. That wasn't it. And then there was, we three podcasters have come from afar, bringing news from not where you are. Yeah. And there was mine, tanker held, tanker held.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, none of them were right. So then I settled on this one. Being a singer of the group, this one came out. I'm dreaming of a geeks podcast, just like the ones I've grown to love, where Rob is funny and Dan is me and Mac spend hours editing shows. I'm dreaming of a geeks podcast, one without pops and editing, where we're all in one room with mics in full bloom and Oshkosh's legendary hospitality. I'm dreaming of a geeks podcast and thankful for the friends it's made me. I'm happy to state these guys are so great. I'm happy to spend Sundays with them. Merry Christmas, Court, Dan, Grant, Max, Peter, Steve, and Merry Christmas to our listeners.
Wow. All right, David. Wow.
David, we've got to give you a week off more often, bud.
Yeah, boy.
That was pretty awesome.
You went crazy. Wow.
Outstanding.
I think what needs to happen is this summer at Oshkosh, we should get a live rendition.
Okay, that's fine.
Sounds good.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Well, Grant, you know, we've made so much money out of advertising out of PCDU this year that we thought perhaps rather than buying presents, we'd just buy a whole factory right here in China.
Yeah, I know, but unfortunately we didn't earn that much. We couldn't buy the whole factory, but we've been able to buy a bit of the production line.
Yeah, wow, it's very noisy.
Yeah, no, it is a bit noisy, so let's come into the office and see if we can meet our contact person, one of the local Chinese ladies here.
Grant, does she speak English?
No, she doesn't.
Oh, well, you're the resident linguist here, Grant. Here, you translate for me.
Oh, okay, here we go. 你好吗,诗诗?
你好,邪恶的外国型人才.
She says hi, Steve.
Oh, right. Well, hello.
欢迎来到我们敬爱的邪汉工厂,它是由伟大的洋鬼子利用,例如自己的荣幸.
She says welcome aboard.
Yes, nice to see that everybody's being treated in a fair and equitable manner here in our very fair factory.
We like place, how product go?
我们已经降低了我们的产品质量从来没有之前的水平，以满足您的小预算的思想.
She says it was tricky, but they've managed to do it.
Oh, very, very good. You know, Grant, I notice over in the corner there I can see some Tiger Airways uniforms. Obviously, they're very high quality here.
That's right. We had to get what we could afford, mate.
恕我直言,从南俄魔鬼的土地,我们应如何传播产品,如果你没有钱?
What did she say there, Grant?
It's really hard to get, but I think she said, how are we going to ship it back home?
I don't know. We're running a little bit low on cash, Grant. I think we'll have to use the cheapest possible option.
Oh, not Chinese Post again.
Well, it was that or Tiger, Grant, so take your pick. Anyway, let's step out here onto the factory floor and have a look at some of the things we've had made up for the guys this year for their Christmas presents.
Yeah, I think there's a showroom we can get to just on the other side. Just make sure you watch out for all the equipment here. You don't want to get yourself crushed in by one of the presses.
Well, Grant, have a look at some of these experimental items. This is the most experimental one we've got right now. Look, it's a wind-up Dan Webb doll.
Oh, wow, cool.
Here, wind it up and see how it goes.
Go for it, yeah.
I am here to please shut up.
Sounds authentic.
Oh, that's odd. Should it be doing that?
I don't know. Gee, quick, take the batteries out of it or something.
I can't get to it. I don't know where the batteries... Oh, I don't even want to think of where the batteries go. But how... We've got to turn this thing off.
Oh, my God. Look, watch out for those sparks.
Shut up.
Hey, quick, hit the emergency button. There's got to be some way of cutting it off.
There's smoke coming out of it.
Hang on, I found the reset button. Here we go.
Ah, the Dan Webb doll of tranquility. That should be a bestseller, I think.
I reckon, especially that last bit. They must have really got into his head for that one.
Yeah, well, check this out. One, you know, our friend David's always been looking for a new recording device, so we had them make one especially just for him. Yeah, you got to wind it up first, but look what happens when you press the record button.
If you're recording, Vischer, you're dead meat.
Wow, man, you must have really wound it up.
Yeah.
Sorry, I had to do it.
And look over here in the corner. Here's a selection of other Airplane Geeks merchandise that we've had made.
Oh, wow. Man, they're going to really love these personalized toys.
Yeah, have a look at them. There's four extra ones here, one for each other contributor. Look, I'll wind up the Max Flight doll right now. You start with the Binet doll.
Okay.
We'd also like to thank our foreign correspondents, Steve Vischer and Grant McCarran. You'll understand everything after you hear this episode.
And if you'd like to call the Airplane Geeks, call 321-GEEKS-01.
Check out the Peter Johnson doll. It's even got a British flag on it.
That's an interesting place to put the British flag, mate.
This is Peter Johnson from across the pond. Groovy, baby. Today, the Airplane Geeks. Tomorrow, the world.
What's that rather old-looking doll over there in the corner? Oh, look, it's got dust and cobwebs all over it. Quick, see if that one still works.
Okay, well, the packaging looks a little wrinkled.
Hey, this is Rob Mark from JetWine.com. People probably don't know that I'm a jolly fellow. Anyway, they can find us at JetWine.com.
Wow, that's a pretty cool collection. Hey, Steve, I thought you said there were only four.
It's truth. They're coming off the production line at a great rate of knots.
Oh, mate, there's stacks of them. They're all standing up. They're all starting to talk. I didn't wind them up.
They're looking rather angry. Quick, Grant, let's get through this robot-proof door.
And, they're coming out of the walls. They're coming out of the walls.
Quick, behind the robot-proof door.
Okay, quick. Steve, mate, how are we going to get out of here?
Well, what about we take a Qantas A380?
Nah, they only just got their 7th, but the 8th was delayed. They won't have space for us.
That sounds bad. And even Singapore Airlines is getting a bit annoyed with Rolls-Royce.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I don't blame them. I mean, you know, they are causing problems for everyone now with an A380, but... Okay, so if the A380's out, how about we use Virgin Blue? The ACCC just approved their alliances with Air New Zealand and Etihad.
Yeah, that's cool. Let's fly Virgin.
Yeah, no, that'll be... Oh, hang on. No, sorry. Whoops. Can't do that. Neither of those alliances covers Asia yet.
Well, there's always the chance that they'll join the Star Alliance and get some global coverage.
Yeah, well, that'd be great. That'd give them a whole world network, but I don't think we can wait that long, mate.
Plus, Air New Zealand has acknowledged that they're going to be waiting a very long time for their 787s.
Yeah, true. They're going to have those 777s, but their game-changing 787s are going to be even more delayed. Ah, yeah, it's not looking good for that, is it? So what about the Convair 550 water bombers?
Cool, but oh, hang on. They're in Ballarat in Victoria. That's close to Melbourne, but right now we're not. We're in China.
Oh, yeah, good point. Dang. Well, you know, if we're close to China, maybe we can get to Singapore. Because if we can get to there, we can use Jetstar's new base, their operational base that they've set up, and take advantage of some of their latest flights direct to Melbourne.
Well, I'm all up for flying Jetstar. I know you don't like them, but how are we going to get out of this building?
Oh, yeah. Here we are, kind of stuck, aren't we? Well, I didn't really want to have to do this, but here we go. X-ray Delta 7, this is Lotus Green. Initiate Pattern Alpha. Over.
What the heck are you doing?
Oh, mate, it's this really cool app that I've got on my Android. I've just used it to call our friends in the RAAF and initiated a surgical JDAM strike from a set of F-18 Rhinos orbiting with their KC-45 tanker under control of a wedge-tail AEW system. How cool is that?
That sounds awesome. What does it mean for us?
Well, what it means is they're going to put a really big bomb or two into this building from a great distance, and they're going to totally destroy the building and everything in it. How neat!
Well, that's really cool, Grant, except that, of course, we're still in this building and we can't get out.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, mate.
What now lies in fate for our podcasting pair of pilots? Have they finally met their end through the machinations of the inscrutable mandarins and their Machiavellian machines? Or can our dynamic digital duo once more live to fight another day using only their Antipodean wits and a packet of Lapsang Souchong tea? To find the answers to this and many other questions, tune in to the next episode of The Australia Desk, only on Airplane Geeks. Lapsang Souchong tea is not recommended be taken in panda bear flavour.
Oh, man. I love those guys.
That was really, really good.
I knew it eventually would show up. We were having a conversation one evening, and Grant and Steve and I were talking, and I made some comment, and then I realized Steve was recording. Got to be careful when talking to him.
Yeah, huh? Yeah, absolutely.
I think those guys melted down this time. No doubt about it.
I love the themed reports, the Australia Desk reports. They do take a huge amount of work for those guys, and we really appreciate them doing that. But
what I like is I really liked for the episode they had like the cliffhangers, and mm-hmm. I like how they're bringing that back.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, Stephen Grant sent along one quick additional message, and I'll play that now.
Well, here we are, folks. Fear not. We're actually okay, you know.
Really? Are we? I thought I was in small, tiny bits going in all different directions.
Well, now that the fun's over, that's the last Oz Desk for 2010. We just wanted to say to all the Airplane Geeks listeners and to all the Airplane Geeks crew, our great friends over there, even though we've never met you in real life, we'd like to wish you all a very Merry Christmas and a safe and prosperous New Year.
Yeah, mate. You do realise they're probably our friends because they haven't met us in real life.
Well, that's exactly true. In fact, if they heard the last Oz Desk, they may never speak to us again.
Well, better play this bit before they listen to the Oz Desk.
That's exactly right. Anyway, folks, thanks for all the fun this year. We'll be back next year for the Oz Desk. And don't forget, episode 50 of Playing Crazy Down Under will be out between Christmas and New Year's. We hope you can come along and join in the fun. Until next year, cheers, folks.
Yeah, take care, folks. Have a great Christmas, Hanukkah, Festivus, whatever it is you're celebrating at the moment, whichever pagan festival you want to go with. And we'll see you in the new year.
That's a wrap, Grant. Look, it's only 2:30 in the morning.
Oh, mate, it's early.
Yeah, well, what do we do now?
I don't know. Want to have a beer?
Yeah, might as well. Wait for the sun to come up.
Oh, yeah.
Sit down at the beach.
That's a very weird thing when you're that far ahead in the time zone, though. When I was over in Dubai a couple of weeks ago, I would be getting ready to go to sleep, and I'd talk to my daughter. She'd text me or something, and she was just getting up, getting ready to go to school.
Yeah.
And just
it's strange.
Life is just very weird. Yeah, it really is.
All right. Well, we've got a Across the Pond segment from Peter Johnson. Peter somehow snagged a very interesting guest.
Today's guest is a real treat for all airplane geeks. He's over 6,800 hours of flying experience as both a recreational, commercial pilot, as well as a CFI. His type ratings are endless, and he's flown everything from small Cessnas, business jets, and regional airliners right up to the mighty A380. He's written 5 aviation books, is CEO of a successful marketing business, and is an adjunct faculty member at Northwestern University in Chicago. He's lived in East Anglia. He regularly appears as an aviation expert in the written press, on the airwaves, and on TV, and also writes one of the best aviation blogs, the award-winning jetwine.com. Rob, thanks for joining us, and welcome to Across the Pond.
Oh, Peter, listen, thank you very much for taking the time to ring over the pond.
You spent a little bit of time in the east part of England, and you were in the U.S. Air Force. Did you get a chance to fly when you were over here?
No, actually, I didn't fly when I was in the U.S. Air Force. In fact, I was an air traffic controller in the radar room there at Weathersfield. So the good part of it was that we would just kind of open the door to the trailer because we were out near the end of the runway, and we could watch all the jets go by. We had F-100s at Weathersfield, which most people listening might not even know what those are.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the other aircraft that you've flown in Europe over the years. Can you tell us what some of the aircraft that you've flown while you've been over here?
Well, sure. I think I have had a chance to fly a number of times with the folks from Dassault. I do love the Dassault airplanes. I really do. Someone asked me on the show a couple of weeks ago which airplane I loved most of all, and I didn't even have to hesitate that the Falcon 7X was my favorite. I mean, it's a fly-by-wire side stick control three-engine, I think 50,000 or 60,000 pound jet that flew like a fighter. And I think that's the thing I love about the Dassault products, is that they're all designed, built, tested by a bunch of folks that used to fly in the French Air Force. Navy pilots, Air Force pilots. No wonder they fly like fighters. They are big fighters.
How do you transition from handling something like that to the mighty A380 that you had the opportunity to fly?
Well, you know what's really funny about that is that I had a chance to fly with Bill Kerrville, who is the chief test pilot at Dassault in the Falcon, and we were getting ready to depart from Toulouse. And I had never flown a fly-by-wire airplane. I had never flown an airplane with a side stick. And I told him that I was a flight instructor. And he said, well, that's wonderful. He said, I can teach most pilots how to fly this airplane in 10 seconds. But you're a U.S. flight instructor. He said, it may take you 20, but that's okay. He said, you'll feel very at home with the airplane. And honest to goodness, we rolled down the runway. And of course, for the listeners, a fly-by-wire, there isn't the visual feedback that you're used to in a regular airplane. So that if you move the stick, you don't really see the opposite side stick moving.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work that way. It just sits there. It kind of looks like the game control when you're playing flight sim. And what I did come to realize very quickly on is that the control inputs are so minor that even to watch your hand, you would barely see your hand moving, and the airplane was doing, 30-degree banks left, 30-degree banks right, and you're just, it was just unbelievable. And, of course, the A380, I think, was not quite as good as the 7X, although on a scale of 1 to 10, if the 7X was a 10, I'd say the 380 was maybe a 9.8.
That's really interesting for such a big, heavy aircraft.
And honest to goodness, I felt the same thing when one of the senior test pilots, we flew in that. And honestly, same thing. When we were climbing out 180 knots or something, and I said, can I play with it a little bit? And he said, oh, sure, you know, do, you know. And I was, that's exactly what I did, is I was just kind of flipping that stick left and right. And this, I think we're at about 850 or 900,000 pounds at that point. And it obviously didn't flip around quite as quickly as the Falcon, but
yeah.
I was amazed at how responsive that airplane was, even at that weight.
What's it like for you being predominantly a US-based pilot, then flying in French airspace? What was ATC like? And
every so often, though, I did notice that when there was a point that the fellow in the right seat wanted to make, he would speak French and he would look over at me and say, look, this is what I just told him, because it was very important for them to keep me in the loop as to what they were doing, because, yeah. You know, we're all pretty much used to flying in English, but in certain places it's very different. So again, that can be a real issue, even though we're all speaking the same English.
What other aircraft did you fly when you were over in Europe, Rob?
Well, let's see. I also flew the Falcon 2000, the Dassault airplane.
Very tricky plane.
I had a chance to. Here's a weekend. Here's a weekend that most airplane geeks would really be amazed at. That I arrived in Paris, caught a regional flight down to Toulouse, and then the next day went through a technical briefing on the A380. Went out and flew that. Came back. Had one of the Dassault pilots pick me up at Toulouse in his Bonanza. I have a great picture of his VTOL Bonanza sitting next to the A380. I'll have to share.
Yeah, that'll be a good
great
one.
Shot. Yeah. And then he flew me to Bordeaux, where I had another briefing on the Falcon 2000. We flew it back from Bordeaux to Teterboro in New York. That was that was a pretty cool weekend.
Yeah, there'll be so many airplane geeks out there, very very jealous of that. Just tell us what makes flying so interesting to you. What's your aviation fix?
Well, it's interesting, but I remember the first time, a couple of first times, I think, when I was probably 9 or 10. Chicago Midway Airport was the busiest airport in the U.S. and could see everything down there at the time. Of course, certainly DC-3s, but I mean DC-6s, DC-7s, Constellations, just about every kind of propeller-driven airplane you could imagine. I didn't want to leave. And then maybe a year later, I was at a county fair, and there was somebody giving rides in an old Bell 47 helicopter. I went up with this fellow. My aunt allowed me to do it because she knew my mother would never let me do that. And just said, oh my God, I came down out of the helicopter and I said, Auntie, I've got to be involved in airplanes.
Well, listen, Rob, I think you truly are an airplane geek. Thanks so much for joining me on Across the Pond.
Thanks, Peter. It's been very enjoyable.
You can find me on Twitter at Nascot Hornet or on the web at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from Across the Pond.
Okay, so maybe I sounded a little geeky.
No, you know, when I listened to it at the beginning, when Peter was given the introduction, and I'm listening to it, and I'm thinking, wow, this sounds like an amazing guy. Who is this? Who is this?
No, it's only Rob.
And, and then after a while, yeah, it started to come together, and I go, he's got Rob.
Well, you know what's really funny is when Peter called to suggest that, I said, oh, don't be silly. Who's going to want to listen to all that junk about me? And he said, you know, we don't really know a whole lot about any of you guys. So hopefully, I mean, he's going to, you know, we're going to have sections for all of us, because, you know, I think people would be interested in knowing how we got to be as geeky as we are. Yeah. I can't pick on Dan anymore, I guess.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. No, that was really well done. That was enjoyable. Okay. Well, I think that's it. This is our last episode for 2010. We're off next week for the holidays, so we'll see you all in January. I want to thank everyone for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. And we'd like to thank our guest for this episode. That was Jillian Gustafson. She's a board member with the National Air Disaster Alliance Foundation. You can find that group on the web at planesafe.org. And Jillian tweets at planesafe.org. As always, we'd like to thank Steve Vischer and Grant McCarron from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast for their Australia Desk Report. Be sure to take a look at their podcast. It's quite a good production, very enjoyable. Also, we want to thank Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond report. Everyone for their holiday well wishes. And let's see, let's tell folks where we can be found online. David Vanderhoof, let's start with you.
I can be found on Twitter at DMVanderhoof, or you can find me on either one of my blogs, whatjustflewby.com or hhg2ma.blogspot.com, which is The Hitchhiker's Guide to Military Aviation.
Great. And Rob Mark, how about you?
Well, let's see. We wish you a Merry Christmas. Oh, that's right. David's the singer. Right?
Yeah, he is.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to steal it from David.
You can steal it anytime you want.
It's just as well that I don't sing, really. I'm going to go back to playing some Angry Birds here. And people can find us at jetwine.com and jetwine on Twitter. And gosh, thank you, everybody, for such a great 2010. I mean, I'm so happy to have been a part of this group. And despite, and Peter, that the pounds will be in the mail there, buddy. Thanks for that cool shout there.
And Dan Webb, how about you?
Well, you can find my blog at thingsinthesky.com. You can find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage. And I'd also like to thank everyone for listening. I Max keeps better track of the numbers than the rest of us, but I think it's been a very good year for us in terms of attracting new listeners. So thanks, everyone, for telling your friends about us and listening.
I'm Max Flight. You can find me at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory or on Twitter at Max Flight. Be sure to see airplanegeeks.com for show notes, links, listener comments, and even t-shirts. You can follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and on Facebook. We're also on Stitcher, stitcher.com, where you can download us. Someone's playing Angry Birds again.
Oh, sorry. Okay, sorry.
We're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us to your mobile phone. If you'd like to send us email, that's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. What we'd really like you to do is send us an MP3 recording or call our listener line and leave a recording there. And Benet Wilson will tell us what that number is.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Benet.
Can I ask a question before we go, though?
Is it quick?
Well, yeah, real quick. I mean, do we really want to be encouraging more plane crazy down unders and Peters and all the, there's not going to be any time left for us guys. I mean,
well, that might
we're
be
going to put ourselves out of a job.
You know what we could do is we could say we're only going to do two. So if a new one comes in, then we got to vote one segment.
Unless, off the island.
yeah, there you go. Yeah, I like that.
Okay.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Absolutely.
Happy New Year.
Happy holidays, and we'll see you next year on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Happy Thanks New for Year. Listening.
Merry Christmas, Harriet.
Well, see, Delta has been making shifts to increase cross-functional synergies to enhance customer satisfaction and profitability.
What the hell does that mean?
I don't know if it sounds good.
Yeah.
Bingo!
Oh, that's staying in.
I'm going to use that in my writing class. Talk about jargon.
You're welcome.
Rob, did you get that? Because I'm sure there'll be a test later.
Rob's on mute.
Either that or he's engrossed in a game of Angry Birds.
It could be.
By the way, I have a really important question for everybody. What should I get for room service tomorrow morning?
Eggs Benedict.
Now, should I get the traditional Eggs Benedict or the Savannah Crab Cakes Eggs Benedict?
Are you a shellfish guy?
Yes.
Go for the crab.
Yes, he is very shellfish.
All right, just wondering.
Jill, would you come back at this point?
She's speechless.
Wow, okay.
All right, anybody else have any other questions?
Yes.
Go ahead.
If you could be any animal.
Dan, is this just for me or for everybody?
I just like tossing out random pointless questions. Okay. Oh, the Fly Delta Jet sign is on. Oh, it's so pretty. Sorry.
Dan's in heaven.
And obviously, Jillian, you can tell that Dan needs to get out just a little more.
I think I'm just like a dog. Like, I just see something, I just get easily distracted. All right. I'm going to stop talking now and put myself on mute.
Great, thank you.
It's the first time I've heard Max say that.
But Dan didn't tell us what kind of animal he'd like to be. Or would he be?
Wow.
You'd already had the answer in your head.
Maybe some kind of chinchilla, just because I like the name.
Okay. I thought it'd be the soft and fuzzy thing, you know. That's not it.
Okay, I want to hear how this is going to sound when we make this transition from you know, TWA.
May I have your attention, please? A fire emergency has been reported in the building.
Oh.
Oh my God.
Seriously.
Get out! Oh, wait a minute.
May I have your attention, please?
Hold on a second.
Dan, get out.
I know. Yeah. Gosh, yes, don't
screw with that stuff, man.
No.
Get out of there.
It says a standby, so I'm going to stand by.
I wouldn't be standing by, man. I'd be out of there.
Get ready to move, Dan.
Let me put shoes on.
Okay.
Take your computer.
Yeah, that's right. That's the first thing to go.
I have no idea. I couldn't understand a word they were saying. No, seriously. They were pretty good. And we don't speak quite the same way you do either, yeah. Even though we all know you guys have it correct.
But of course, we taught you.
Absolutely.
That'll go down well in the show, I'm sure. I'll cut that bit out.
And now I'm headed over to your house. In fact, did you know I'm coming to stay at your house tonight?
My basset hound is laying on his bed, and he's waiting for you to come and give him a big cuddle.
PLANSAFE.
PlaneSafe.org. PlaneSafe.org.
PlaneSafe.org.
PlaneSafe.org.
Okay. I think. Okay. All right. They've probably got it by now.